critical illness begins a very serious journey where there is a disconnect between one's sense of embeddedness in one's own body to all of a sudden being contained within a persecutory object.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Gavriel Hertz. Dr. Hertz is a nephrologist at the Humber River Hospital in Toronto, Canada, and he is a psychoanalyst and a member of the Canadian Psychoanalytic Society. This, of course, is an unusual combination, a nephrologist and a psychoanalyst, and we're going to discuss their interface in today's interview. Dr. Hertz is also an associate professor at the University of Toronto, and he is the founder of psychonephrology.com. Dr. Hertz will describe to us today how he has brought his psychoanalytic sensitivities to his work in nephrology and in dialysis units. And through his writings and lecturing worldwide, he has had an important influence on how dialysis is understood and carried out, not only in Canada, but around the world. Here is my interview with Dr. Hertz. Gavriel, welcome to our podcast. It's a pleasure to have you with us. I want to start us off by congratulating you on your winning the IPA in Health Committee Award. This is a new award established by the International Psychoanalytic Association, and it honors those analysts that do work in the community. Could be in the medical world, it could be in the legal world, in a number of different worlds. And you won from the IPA and Health Committee because of your really fascinating and vital work that you've done bringing your psychoanalytic sensitivities to medicine and nephrology, which we're going to talk about and introduce to a wider audience than have known about it up to now. I was delighted to learn about your work in seeing your application for the award, and I was troubled that I hadn't heard of it. So I and others are now going to learn about it. So congratulations again.
Thank you for the recognition.
Gavriel, I know a number of analysts who began their medical careers in other specialties. I don't know anyone who began as a nephrologist. And I also don't know anyone who continues to practice their initial specialty while also practicing as a psychoanalyst. So I'm sure I'm not the first to note the unique position that you're in. And this leads me to a particular question that's been on my mind for a long time, actually. I've known a number of physicians in the office and outside of the office. And it occurs to me, especially with those physicians that work with patients with life-threatening illnesses, as you do, that doctors commonly and understandably developed a sort of characterologic veneer when faced with the overwhelming and at times confusing affects of their frightened patients. It seems to me that you, as an analyst, are in a position to do something somewhat different than simply develop that veneer, that as a result of your training and experiences, you're in a position to tune into those affects that your frightened patients have, to be able to listen to the at times fantastical fantasies that us humans develop in the face of serious and life-threatening illness. So if what I'm saying is true, you're in a very special position. You're in the position of being the essence of a physician. That is, that you can listen to the inner life of a person while also having expertise and attending to their physical life. Share with us, if you would, if you think my characterization is a fair one, and if it is, what it is you've been able to learn being in that very unique position of really the essence of physicianhood, is the way I would call it.
Well, that's it's a very good question. And I guess I can posit it first by saying that I think the analytic perspective has been very helpful in understanding on a more profound level the storm that our patients occupy. And, you know, when I think of the storm that's around us in the process, in the midst of severe physical illness, I don't think it involves purely the patient, but it involves their social support system. So I always tell families that it's not the individual who becomes ill, it's the family unit that becomes ill. And to a greater or lesser extent, the clinicians looking after them, and that includes nurses and physicians. I think we're all in the same boat together, although we may not recognize it or wish to acknowledge it, as you said, and perhaps for our own self-protection. But I think that also, I think we have to look at the context of what I'm speaking about also within a wider context of where healthcare has evolved to and the shifting paradigm of healthcare at this junction. And I guess the way I would sort of look at it is that we've moved from, and this I guess began perhaps in the 80s, we've moved away for giving equal recognition to perhaps the empathetic side of medical care to focusing more on a problem solution perspective or philosophy of care. So it's sort of has become more evidence-based, more pragmatic, more quantitative, and in that sense has become dissociated, I think, from the qualitative aspects of caring. And those have been sort of more relegated to the nursing journals, the social work arenas, and has not been appreciated as really being part and parcel of medical care, even though every clinical encounter has that flip side to it. It has both the actual tangible aspect of an abnormal lab result, an abnormal blood pressure, a prescription, but also how that's ascertained and communicated in that interpersonal sphere. So I think in a way, that's my appreciation of medicine today. And that's been heightened by the sheer volume of patients that we're dealing with. So, I mean, our own program in Toronto, a dialysis program, and it's not really the largest in Toronto, we have 600 patients on dialysis. I mean, that way outstrips any social worker, any ability of social workers or even psychiatrists being able to provide care for these patients. And so hence, you know, the challenge is having that analytic perspective, you know, how do you deliver that care that you feel is important for these patients?
I'm waiting for your description. You've just presented a very daunting proposal. You have 600 patients in dialysis, and you would like to bring a psychoanalytic sensitivity to their work. Okay, I got the challenge. So what's the answer?
It's interesting because when I had a chance to discuss this with colleagues who are medical directors of huge nephrology dialysis delivery systems in the U.S. where they have tens of thousands of patients. And they said to me bluntly, you know, we agree with you. I think delivering that kind of care is important. Can you fax us a sheet telling us what to do?
Exactly. Right.
You know, but, you know, in a humorous way, that kind of outlines the dilemma that we are in healthcare today. And again, in terms of, I think psychiatry itself is an issue, that area, because it's in itself has become a medical subspecialty. So, you know, the areas that I deal with are patients who are, quote unquote, using the parlance of the hospital, are acting out or they're behaving in a bizarre manner because there's an appreciation of cognitive dissonance. How is this person who is a professor and a PhD can't remember to take his medications or fill his prescription or has been trained to do home dialysis and now has forgotten everything? And there's a complete lack of the functioning of the mind. And as a result, the patients are really not helped by the treatments.
So what is your intervention?
You know, the intervention didn't come ad hoc. You know, it took years of, I guess, being immersed in the analytic milieu. And I think I've been greatly helped by that. I guess for me, there was a self-evolution. And I think that self-evolution needs to happen before one can begin to help externally. So one has to integrate a certain understanding. And I guess where it started for me was that illness begins a journey. Physical illness, or serious physical illness, chronic physical illness, begins a very serious journey where there is a disconnect between one's sense of embeddedness in one's own body, a kind of narcissistic union where there's no space, to all of a sudden being contained within a persecutory object. And so I think there's a lifelong navigation of being trapped within an ailing body. I think, you know, and perhaps this enhances our own empathy. In a way, we are all on that journey. Even if we're fortunate to avoid a major illness, I think the aging process itself introduces that disconnect and that need to negotiate the occupation of an ailing body.
Let me interrupt you, but just so we can spend a moment on that, because it seems vital. If I want to understand what you're saying, you're describing that one's relationship with one's body changes, either through aging or, in the case of your patients, through serious medical illness, where we don't take it for granted. It becomes a thing that is sick, a thing that hurts, a thing that terrifies us. And it's then a thing sort of removed from us. And it's not necessarily a friendly thing. It is a dangerous thing. And that's the new negotiation you're describing. Do I follow that correctly?
Exactly. Exactly. You know, in that process, and perhaps this is where analysis is also helpful, we each have our own unique regressive phenomena or patterns. And so I think that in a way, illness takes us to our regressive core areas. And I think it takes us to our almost fundamental traumatized areas. You know, the analogy I use with patients and other clinicians is that it's as if you take an elevator straight to the sub-basement. And those, to me, the trauma perspective is very helpful, because those are the areas that are dissociated, that are filled with death anxieties. And the work is then to help the patients create a narrative through an object relationship, through transferential phenomena, so that perhaps they can begin to go and climb onto the base, into the basement, and perhaps reach the first floor. But then on, there's always going to be that oscillation between the basement, the sub-basement, and the first floor.
Now, let me ask you about that, because we've all had the experience putting our own selves as patients aside for just a moment. But we've worked with patients in analysis who have struggled with the disintegration, integration of themselves into coherent and good object self-experiences, and how challenging and difficult and tumultuous that can be. But of course, you're not describing working with patients in analysis. You're working with patients, I don't know how intensively, but it would seem to me, absent that dyadic intensity, you then rely on the structure to apply it sort of in mass to make a group intervention. Is that correct?
Well, I guess I'm not sure if I understood completely, but you know, I have worked in the past in psychoanalysis with patients, where one patient on dialysis, but most commonly I will see patients once or twice a week in face-to-face psychotherapy, and for prolonged periods of time, and then they may stop and then they may come back. And so it becomes a sort of a fluid situation in terms of their comings and goings. And just to make it more complex in terms of the frame that I occupy, I may see the patient in therapy, but I may then see them tomorrow in the emergency room. And so,
how does that work?
Well, I guess, you know, initially, you know, in my own self-evolution, you know, because of as you're learning psychoanalysis, you know, the frame has to be kept sacrosanct. You know, there was a kind of quandary for me, or, you know, how do I manage this? And I think I was helped by understanding the analogy that really, you know, that's what a family physician used to do, or could do, you know, because a family physician essentially is both a therapist and a somatic physician. And he doesn't say, okay, now, right now I'm doing this versus doing that, or I should only be doing one or the other. In a way, you're a complete physician, if we can use that adjective.
So what I and perhaps others are learning is that the challenge of the frame is one of the challenges of working analytically off the couch, because it obviously can't be the same frame as inside our consulting rooms. The nature of off the couch is that it's off the couch. And we're trying to tease out among ourselves, what does that mean? What do we lose by also working off the couch? And maybe also, what do we gain by that? And you have lots of experiences that can shed light, perhaps, on both those vantage points.
No, I mean, and I'm not sure I necessarily have the answer to that, but it was an evolving perspective. And so what I mean is, you know, when I started my training, everybody always asked me, so when are you going to give up nephrology and become a full-time therapist? And, you know, when you're sort of first making your way through psychoanalysis, and I didn't really have an extensive, or I had no psychotherapy background, I was really in a quandary in terms of how will things evolve? And I guess I was sort of fortunate in both in terms of my analyst who had a psychosomatic perspective, and it was a very transformative experience, and the supervisions I had down the road, that it kind of solidified my own identity as integrating both the psyche and the soma care that I provide. And also that perspective is really how the patients come. So patients don't come with, I have a somatic abnormality. It's just our own perspective that diminishes. And the way I always try to find metaphors with which to teach the hospital milieu, the biological world. And what I say is, it's up to you to decide if you want to see your patient in black and white or in color. I think it's much more helpful and more interesting if you decide to see your patients in color as opposed to being colorblind. So I find that a very useful way to look at it. And as I said before, I think that we all started as physicians being both empathetic and mindful of these issues and biologically aware in terms of the issues. And it's just, how do we integrate it? And I think I agree with your first comment that perhaps our dissociation of that aspect may be for our own counter-transferential issues.
Describe, if you would, what your actual work is, what it is you do on a day-to-day basis that allows you the opportunity for this integration.
So, I mean, I function full-time as a nephrologist, which means I look after patients in a dialysis unit. I look after patients who are admitted to the hospital. Then I do, between late afternoon and dinner, I have a psychotherapy practice. And the psychotherapy practice is really for patients who are dealing with serious physical illness. So these may be patients on dialysis, who recently started dialysis, patients who cannot bring themselves to agree to have a renal transplant. They have some reason for that, or dealing with some other illnesses. That's my psychotherapy practice. But another aspect of what I do is I'm constantly trying to find ways of enhancing the awareness within a biomedical milieu, within the hospital environment, within the dialysis program, of bringing these kinds of perspectives to life and sort of convincing people that this is important and we need to pay attention to the emotional lives of the patients as much as we pay attention to their serum hemoglobin or their blood pressure. And that has been the challenge, you know, that I've kind of set for myself.
And you have outcome research that seems very convincing when I read it. Can you share it with our audience?
I guess to me, the challenge was, how do I bring an awareness of this area to a world that really looks at quantitative information and is used to only seeing quantitative information? So that was sort of the challenge for me. And it's interesting, you know, when I've done a lot of talks in North America to analytic groups and nephrology groups, which has honed this awareness. And what I realized that everybody would say, like on the nephrology side, you know, we agree that this is very important, but we really don't know what to do. Or if we're in the dialysis program and somebody is acting in a quote-unquote bizarre manner, which is sort of in a regressive manner, to say, oh, Gavril, this is your kind of patient. Why don't you look after this patient? So that was sort of an identification. But I realized very quickly that I needed to generate data that was quantifiable, that had a p-value attached to it, because then the renal world would say, you know what, you're right. You know, we agree that there is something here. And so what I did was I latched onto using quality of life data, which some of these questionnaires have been standardized for dialysis patients. And then there was another bank of questionnaires that the NIH created called PROMIS for patients coping with all kinds of chronic diseases. And so I began to apply quality of life measures to the patients to see if that could generate useful data. And what I quickly realized that the focus that I came onto was the transition. I think that the regression, anxiety, depression, dissociation, death anxieties were most heightened during the time of transition, when patients started dialysis or when patients had a transplant. And so I applied these quality of life measures before patients start dialysis, at the initiation of dialysis, and 6 weeks later. And it was interesting that, you know, when patients initiated dialysis, anxiety and depression levels were very high, cognitive levels were low. And then with time, patients returned to their baseline. If you use an analytic perspective, it makes a lot of sense. Of course, if your anxiety is high, then your cognitive functioning is going to be reduced. But these aspects are not that well appreciated in the medical milieu. And so using this kind of data, you know, I was able to convince the hospital to apply for a transition unit, which was almost like a cocoon area of six dialysis stations where patients who first started dialysis would be treated in this area. And I worked very closely with the nurses to create a psychosocial model of care, which focused not just on the medical side, but on providing more psychosocial awareness and care to the patients beyond the factory approach of you come in, you go on the machine, 4 hours later, you go off the machine.
That's what I sort of meant before when I talked about the group structure. In place of the intense one-on-one transference, you borrowed the group intervention, which is, I guess, what you're describing now.
That was the group. And I must admit that, you know, I initially started by doing balanced groups with the hopes that containment of the nurses would be translated to containment of the patients. Because at the end of the day, I felt the only personnel that we had in terms of enough resources were really the nurses. And so the question was, how can you train nurses to be more caring and empathetically aware? I think intuitively they are, because otherwise they wouldn't have gone into nursing. But the culture of the hospital kind of doesn't support it. And so the question is, how do you enhance that culture? And so I started doing the balance groups, and then it led to this other area.
And the interventions proved to be effective.
Well, the interventions proved to be very effective because what happened was that the patients who went through this six-week period of enhanced containment, so there we had one nurse for two patients as opposed to normally one nurse for three patients. I even tried to enhance the conversation with the patients, which normally doesn't occur. The nurses are always busy with their computers, EMR, and the dialysis machine rather than the patients. I said, you have to, at the end of each treatment, write a brief conversation you had with the patient, whether it was about walking the dog and the granddaughter's birthday party was, et cetera. But
something personal.
Something personal that would show that you listened and you had a conversation. And I thought that that was an easy way to enhance a therapeutic interaction as opposed to just talking at the patients. And lo and behold, you know, a greater percentage of patients went on to home dialysis and accepted home dialysis and trained for it.
Which is a measure, help us, because if we're not in the nephrology world, we wouldn't know what that means.
So, you know, patients have a choice of dialysis. We're either coming into the hospital 3 to 6 times a week, which is very good treatment, and it does provide some form of socialization. But, you know, we and also the government system encourages home dialysis. It's less expensive. And the mandate for setting up this unit wasn't providing psychosocial care alone. They needed some quantifiable, concrete advantage for funding. The other aspect was show us that you can have more patients accepting home dialysis treatment, which they did. And so in a way, it was a good partnership. And then this became adopted all across Ontario to a greater or lesser extent. And now there are calls from the United States in terms of setting up this program, which I think is very important because, interestingly, the highest mortality rate in dialysis patients is the first 3 months. And up till now, nobody has been able to figure out why that is, you know, even if you normalize for all kinds of biological parameters. But, you know, I wonder, and I don't have the proof, to what extent stress plays a role in it. Because certainly some of the quality of life measures, the depression and the anxiety levels fell into areas that have been associated with two or more times greater mortality risk and hospitalization.
You know, I want to go back to something you said. You ask the nurses to write down one conversation they had with the patient. And it seems to me, if I hear you right, that that was a powerful intervention, not just for the patients, but undoubtedly for the nurses, who, like you say, went into nursing because they wanted personal contact, not just scientific contact. And of course, one doesn't have to choose. One can, as you are evidence of, be skilled in both. But there's another theme that I have picked up in these conversations with analysts who are doing this work off the couch. And what's powerful in what we do is we are interested in patients having the experience of being known. One could say that that is the essence of psychoanalysis itself, to be known in the deepest of levels. And one could say that while, of course, these kinds of patient encounters aren't the deepest of levels like Anna Lassands can experience, but it is a form of being known. And it would not surprise me if the difference between those who have higher mortality versus those who have lower mortality is whether they have the experience that someone in this environment, this medical environment, is interested in knowing them. Because I've heard that from others in the others environment, and that may be, since we know what it's like to be known in our own analyses, maybe that's the special ability we analysts bring in working in medical care. I'm just saying that as a hypothesis for us all to think about.
I mean, I agree with you 100%. You know, I'm sure you're familiar with the patient-centered care drivers now, you know, worldwide. I mean, and how important that's been. I mean, and it's sort of working to a greater or lesser extent because I think, and I'm not sure people necessarily know what patient-centered care is because a lot of the questionnaires are sort of client customer questionnaires in terms of how did you find the parking lot? You know, was it closed, et cetera? But, you know, when you do these studies, the most important aspect that patients identify as important is an empathetic connection and being able to have a conversation. And I think that's exactly what you're referring to is somebody who recognizes you. And if you can build that into your system, your patient-centered care questionnaire outcomes are way off the chart, which is you come to the secretary and you say, and she tells you, look, I'm sorry, we're running a little bit late, but don't worry, we'll get to you as soon as possible versus why don't you have a seat and we'll get to you. Can't you see how busy we are? And you can go from one end of the spectrum to the other, and yet all it took was a 2-second encounter.
And we know the richness of those 2-second encounters because we've lived them on both sides of the couch.
Exactly. And in our own personal experiences with the healthcare system.
Yes, that's what I mean. Sure. I don't want to end our time without your telling us more about psychonephrology.com because we're going to put that in the liner notes, but introduce that to our audience.
You know, as I mentioned before, I was looking at different ways of trying to change the culture or perhaps enhance our awareness of the psychological aspects or the regressive elements of illness. You know, aside from what I've spoken about before, one of the ideas I had was to create, you know, a social media site, a website. And aside from sort of an informational aspect to it, there's a blogging site, you know, and I have different posts by, you know, by patients, clinicians. More recently, I've started posting videos, again, interviews and discussions with patients, which I hope to do more of. But really, it's a site where people can come and congregate. And really, what I have found is that there are people worldwide who are interested in the area, but you may have only one or two at a hospital or in a city. And in a way, we're all isolated and we need to somehow find a way of connecting, just as I guess you are doing.
That's what the podcast is about, exactly. Sure, sure. Gavril, thank you for spending time with us. You began by talking about the storm that is in patients' lives when they become seriously ill, the storm that's in their families, the storms that can be in healthcare centers. But you've also described, both in your words and in your manner, a quiet in the middle of the storm, a quiet attentiveness to your experience, to the patient's experience. And going back to what I asked about the essence of physicianhood, that quietness seems to me to offer a real example of the essence of physicianhood. So I thank you for sharing that with us. I think I and our audience have learned a great deal.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.